morning. Welcome to the International Connection once again. This is show number 45 in the radio series on mind control and the last show with interviews. We are finishing the series with two panel discussions next week on ritual abuse and the following week on government-military mind control. Today we are airing part two of an interview with Gail Fisher-Taylor, a Toronto-based psychotherapist who works with trauma survivors. Also today we will have a short interview with Dr. Connie Christensen, a social psychologist and professor at Carleton University in Ottawa. You're listening to CKLN. Now, in terms of the healing process, of what has to happen in order to break that conditioning, in either examples of dissociation for that conditioning or not, how does a person break that control?
Okay, well, there are a number of factors. There are the short-term factors and the long-term. So in the long-term, what has to happen is the dissociative barriers have to come down, and in some way the person has to both recognize how this programming has happened, how this conditioning has happened, what they're supposed to do, and why they believe that they're supposed to do those things, and what the emotions are often. Primary emotion, even though it may be very masked, will be terror if they don't do what they're told to do or what they're conditioned to do, what they're programmed to do. So in breaking down the dissociative barriers, if there's, let's say that this particular identity believes that they love the perpetrator, and that they would never think of not doing what the perpetrator said. And let's say the perpetrator is telling them to do absolutely horrific things, that part of what needs to happen is that they need to start, they need to go back to how that relationship formed with that perpetrator. And they need to go back to what beliefs they had, and what, in other words, they need to get the whole experience to understand both what they're believing and why they're acting in the way that they are, and to integrate that with the emotions that are probably dissociated away and may in fact be in another identity. So often what has to happen in programming is that various identities have to be sharing information and have to somehow find a way to build those alliances so that there isn't the control over separate identities, but they form an alliance against the people who have done the mind control. Mm-hmm. So that's just one aspect. I mean, it can be very complicated and multi-layered.
So what is your approach to undoing that kind of conditioning and programming, in terms of therapeutic approaches?
Well, I mean, there are many of them. I think that, there are many stages to the therapy. Mm-hmm. It can be very difficult to predetermine exactly what that road is going to be, because different people's programming happens in different ways. So part of what is really important to do is to be understanding what the structure of the identities is, and what kind of co-consciousness is there in the system, what kind of programming is there, how do the layers of programming work, and how do the layers of identities work, because there are layers of memory, there are layers of identities, and it can get very, very complex. But there are techniques that can start to expedite some of this. But what makes it very complicated in working with survivors of purposeful mind control is that often part of the programming is that if the person starts to tell, starts to remember, starts to undo the programming, there are other programs in there that can be triggered off, that might, where they might make a suicide attempt, or they might, even if they weren't returning, let's say that there's a cult that they're supposed to return to and they've been able to resist returning, that they then can't resist anymore. They end up going back to that group that's been abusing them.
I've also heard of reporting alters, of just simply reporting back what happens.
Absolutely. Reporting identities and compliant identities. They're reporting identities are usually very compliant. So that even if a person relocates to get away from a group that's doing this, that it can be very difficult because they have identities inside who will call the group and tell them exactly where they are. So part of the strategy has to be to work with those and get them allied with therapy and compliant, because they can also, that's another technique actually, is that you work with the programming that's there for the perpetrator and you try to use it therapeutically. You try to turn it around. So for instance, a reporting identity will not only report to, let's say, a cult, but they'll also report to the therapist. You know, let's say that there's some sort of scrambling programming that that means that the person's sitting there and that they can't hear clearly what somebody is saying in therapy. That scrambling kind of programming can be very useful when there's something overwhelming that takes over. That it can be useful to use the scrambling programming to scramble it so that it's not an overwhelming, let's say, abreaction or flashback or emotional state. So there are many ways to do it, and it's very complex, and it's very dependent on that particular survivor's history and the kind of mind control that's happened.
Now, I'd like to change the topic a little bit. I want to talk about how in terms of the Canadian legal system, how they have handled cases involving allegations of mind control or sadistic abuse.
Okay. Now I'm talking from a therapist's point of view, and just what I've had some sort of knowledge of is that I think that there's a lot of disbelief that these things happen in our society, and that the legal system, the criminal justice system, if a prosecutor is going to go ahead, let's say it's a criminal charge against somebody, the Crown attorney is going to try to win the case. I mean, they don't prosecute unless they think that they can win the case. And that because the media is so full of information that discredits the existence of this kind of abuse, and who's reading these papers but people who are on juries, judges, that usually what happens is that part of the evidence is either left out or minimized, or the Crown attorney talks about, well, you know, not all of this may, you know, you don't have to believe this in order to prosecute on sexual abuse. So, I mean, we do have a problem because there is a kind of conservative atmosphere in the criminal justice system. It's probably going to be the last to change. And that, you know, it's 25 years ago, it was much more difficult to prosecute on an incest charge. And, you know, there's still psychiatric textbooks in use that say that incest occurs in 1 in 1 million families. Our beliefs about abuse have been totally out of line, and I think that the next 25 years, you know, as more and more information is released from bodies like the CIA in the States, where that document the kind of mind control and mind control experimentation that's been going on, we start getting much more validation. More and more survivors of mind control start speaking out, start going into the legal system, start. Basically getting together and sharing experiences and forming advocacy groups. I think that, you know, the personal is political, that old feminist cliche, that this is what I think will eventually you know, and is. I think there is really a movement that will allow for more and more a gradual kind of credibility, but we have a long way to go, especially with organizations like the False Memory, I refuse to call it syndrome, Foundation.
Call it syndrome.
Yeah.
What kind of the media has certainly played a large part in the public attitude in contributing to that, and I'll say it's disinformation, or they've done in terms of my opinion, a real irresponsible or unthorough job of looking into these issues. Mm-hmm. What is your opinion of how the mainstream media has done in terms of covering issues about mind control and ritual abuse?
Okay, well, we have some basic problems because dissociation is very, very complicated. It's not something that somebody's going to understand in a 5-minute soundbite, you know, or in a soundbite, and let alone 5 minutes, you know. That dissociation, traumatic memory, all of those kinds of that kind of contextual information that lends credibility, provides the context for things that when somebody first meets them may sound very sensational. But if they're taken out of context, it may be very hard for somebody to understand and believe. And if there is then that media bias against the existence of these forms of abuse, mind control, various kinds of sadistic abuse, cult abuse, etc., that what starts to happen is that there's a kind of public brainwashing that's going on. And there's a mass dissociation away from the existence of these really terrible crimes that if people start to believe in them, they start to feel a lot less safe living in our society. Hmm. They start to feel a lot less comfortable about sending their children off to school or off to a birthday party when they realize that these kinds of things happen in those kinds of places.
I think the public guilt has got a part to play in that, and then if they do recognize and start to believe that these kind of things going on, I mean, it just begs public action, and people may be at a loss of what to do about it as well.
Well, I think definitely you're making an important point, is that if people do believe, then they have to act. And you're right, people don't know exactly what to do. But I think that, you know, the survivor movement can lend some real direction here, because I think, you know, there are a lot of very strong survivors out there advocating, informing, forming organizations that are doing some really good work, and that it has to become, I mean, in a way, there's a great metaphor here, just the way that the dissociative barriers inside someone who's been traumatized have to come down. Those barriers have to come down between people, so that there's a group momentum that starts to, you know, force the existence of this reality into the public mind.
Mm-hmm. And your point about just the nature of mainstream media, in that they're so geared towards very quick soundbite oriented information. I mean, it's taken me on this show 40 hours to go through all of this material, and it does take a fair bit of understanding and really looking at it thoroughly to understand all the issues around it in order to be able to believe that this is going on.
I think you're right. And I think also that there's, you know, there's something that goes on socially that I think has a lot to do with our denial about the existence of all kinds of abuse. And that's just the way that we deal with emotion. I mean, I've been talking a lot about how in the healing process what has to happen is the emotions have to be joined with, you know, flashbacks, for instance. That's part of the dissociation. When people dissociate from their emotions, that reality can change shape. Well, I think part of what happens in our society is that there's a real emotional oppression in our culture. And what I mean by that is that when people start getting very emotional, that there are, and it goes back to childhood, really. If all individuals in a particular culture are, when their children, you know, get sad and start to cry, and they say, "Don't cry," or they start to distract them with a toy, right? The message gets across very clearly that crying is not something that that child is supposed to do. Same thing with anger. And when and what happens to that child is that child then dissociates from those emotions. When the child dissociates from their emotions, from, let's say, his emotions or her emotions, that what then happens is when someone comes along with those emotions, let's say we're talking about sadness. Let's say that child was never allowed to cry. So what then starts to happen is when someone else cries, that child may start to get very angry because the child doesn't have access to, let's say, his own tears, and that there's fear around the tears. And with little boys, we often will condition, you might say program, the little boy not to cry, but that it's okay maybe to get angry. And so what will then start to happen is that the tears inside that little boy that might be there in empathy with another child or an adult crying will come out as anger. And that, or maybe what happens is that that child learns that when somebody cries, you walk away. And so what we're talking about is we're talking about horrific events that the normal response to is tremendous emotion, is anger, is rage, is fear, is terror, is, you know, all of these emotions are normal responses to horrific events. But if a person starts gaining access to these emotions and then tries to express them or express events that bring up those emotions in someone else, what's going to happen is dissociation away from them in individual after individual. So as a culture, that there's a moving away from intense emotion. And what happens in that kind of dissociation is that there's denial that this exists. It's much easier to deny that terrible mind control, purposeful mind control happens, or that sadistic cults are abusing children in a terrible way, or that the neighbor is a pedophile. It does demand action, as you're saying, but it also means that in order to empathize, someone has to feel. But if, as a culture, people have learned or been conditioned to suppress their emotions, that what they're going to do is they're going to rationalize something that prevents those emotions from coming out. So part of that rationalization is the denial that this even exists. So it does a number of things. It allows the person to remain in homeostasis, in other words, to not get upset, because if it doesn't exist, you don't have to be upset about it. If it does exist, you not only have to be upset about it, you have to do something about it. You have to keep your children safe. So that... And that I think that the media really feeds into this as well. Hmm. We were also talking about earlier the whole aspect of betrayal. So, for instance, in a family, and this happens over and over again, is that let's say that one member of the family starts to recall these kinds of events of some sort of multi-perpetrator sexual abuse or being in a child pornography ring, and that the father and mother were part of how that child got into the pornography ring, or maybe were even part of that pornography ring, that what happens is that let's say actually that it's one parent that has done this, that, and let's say that's the father, okay, that if then the other children in the family are in the position of being confronted with this, and let's say the same thing has happened to them and they've also dissociated the memory, this information means that they can't maintain the same relationship with that father.
Hmm.
It means that there's a betrayal that has to go on somewhere. Either they were betrayed by that father, or else, and that they have to change that relationship with that father, or that they then can say that that's a betrayal by the child who's telling, saying that the child is making up the story. And this is part of the way both the criminal justice system and the False Memory Foundation have manipulated things, is that it's become a wonderful legal defense to blame the therapist, because that way the adult survivor is not being blamed. And that didn't work well in the courts. Adult survivors who were in a lot of pain and who were basically talking about horrific events that had happened to them, the courts would often lean in their direction a number of years ago. It wasn't until the attorney started getting this defense of, well, okay, it wasn't really, they're not really doing this to the parent. It's that terrible therapist who's just out there to make money that's implanting these memories in order to get this person to come back and so that they can earn money, and that it's the therapist's fault, not this poor victim, who's not a victim of sexual abuse, but who's a victim of the therapist.
And while we're on the topic of False Memory Foundation,
right?
they have had a tremendous impact on the field of psychotherapy. In your opinion, how do you feel that this foundation has affected the quality of therapy?
Well, in a number of ways. I think that it's certainly the existence of the False Memory Foundation and the kinds of issues that they're talking about, the kinds of court cases that they've encouraged their members to proceed with against therapists, I think have made all therapists, or should, if haven't made all of us careful, it should make all of us very careful. In some ways, I think that's had a very positive effect, and in some ways, I think it's had a very negative, harmful effect. Let me talk about the positive first.
Okay.
I think that it's helped a lot of therapists be aware that it is not, it's not only not safe for them in terms of the ending up in court, but it's not good therapy to have suggestive leading questions. It's much better to ask open-ended questions like, can you tell me more? Rather than to ask a leading question like, was it your father who was doing that? That's not good therapy to do that. And it can have an influence on someone if a therapist or anyone continues to suggest something to someone who is suggestible. And they're probably about, a minority of the population that are suggestible, supposedly. But I think the harmful effect is that it certainly elevated the level of fear for therapists. And I think that anyone in therapy, whether, and not just in therapy, but we all as human beings need to have experiences validated. We need to do reality checks. If I talk at one of my children's PTA meetings and I may want to do a check with somebody that was there, was that reasonable what I said? And if I do a check with a number of people that were there, what they say is going to influence how I feel about what I said. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's really important. It's important for us. We're social beings. We need that kind of validation. So if someone's been abused, particularly if they've gone through a kind of abuse that a lot of people don't know exists, like mind control or various kinds of sadistic abuse, they need to have some sort of validation. And this becomes a dilemma, because what is being recommended in a lot of the workshops and a lot of the training that psychiatrists and psychologists and other kinds of psychotherapists go through is that basically the message that you give to the person who's recovering memory is that you have to find out for yourself what your own experience is. Now, on one level, I think that's very true. No one can tell another human being what their experience, what their truth is. But on another level, if the therapist is saying, well, I don't know whether ritual abuse really exists, what they're also saying is, in a way, what they're saying is, I don't know whether you're psychotic or not.
Right.
Because what's psychosis is a disconnection from reality. So there are some really profound implications of the directions that therapists are taking for the safety of, for their own safety, and that I think we really as a profession have to examine. And I think that discussion is good. I think that operating with challenges is very healthy. But I think operating out of fear can be incredibly harmful. And I think that that's what's happening with a lot of therapists. And a lot of therapists are refusing to work with clients that they know are dissociative as a result. But I think that we have to be looking at how can there be good therapy that protects everybody, but also doesn't do the client a disservice.
Mm-hmm. And that expression of disbelief in a general sense of whether ritual abuse exists or not, again, is not good therapy, from my understanding. That creates tremendous trauma in the client again.
Well, okay. I think this brings up another whole area, which is that people don't want to believe that these things have happened to them. So part of the whole process, a healthy kind of therapeutic process, involves self-questioning. Now, it's very important for the therapist not to come in and say, yes, this happened to you, when the survivor is still wondering, did it happen or did it not? But I think that if the therapist is saying, I don't know whether this kind of thing can exist or whether this could have happened to you, and it's basically implanting doubts, that's what's happening, is that the doubts are being fed. I think it's better not to feed the doubts nor to feed the certainty. Mm. I think it is important to stay in some sort of position where the client is able to continue to take the information that's coming up and try to process it in an ethical way for herself or himself, but to also look at, okay, what do you need to, what kind of outside corroboration is there here? So, for instance, if there's another sibling that has similar kinds of experiences, and if the person's not planning on going to court, because you wouldn't want them to be sharing those experiences, because there'd be contamination there of evidence if they were going into the legal system, the criminal justice system. But that can be one form of corroboration. If the sharing happens after both people have been in their therapeutic processes for a period of time, there can be other kinds of corroboration that, let's say, they have a memory of something happening, being transported in a particular kind of car. Now, this is explicit memory, and it could be wrong, but if it's right, it's very powerful. That they didn't know they had a red Ford, in 1964. But in fact, they did, and that there's some way. So to start corroborating, or they didn't know that this little building was located there, and they go back, and there it was. And maybe there was, as in Sybil, there were marks that were made that they remember making during a particular event.